Horizon here on 104.5 FM LP in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. And before we go any further, Damien, our wonderful little...
Of course, our usual disclaimer, right? WRFU is an open forum for the Urbana-Champaign community. Views expressed are those of the speakers and do not reflect are not intended to represent those of WRFU, the UCIMC, or the Urbana Socialist Forum. So
yeah, I'm not in the studio this week because I'm currently on the road driving from Springfield. So Damien's going to be handling the bulk of the news this week, and I'm just going to pull the Damien commentary version. But I'm going to hopefully have something more to say than just wow.
Oh, come on now. Okay.
Hey, I got a rag on you because now you're old.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, my birthday was yesterday. So yeah.
Yes.
You know how it goes. I mean, after you pass 21, nothing really matters anymore, so...
Until you get to 65, that's like the next big day.
Exactly. So, anyway, yeah, I'm a year older. So what's in the news?
Yes.
Let's see. News of the week. Despite no salary cap season for the 2010 NFL season, the league's 2010 draft will continue to operate under the rookie salary pool and slotting system that have been staples of the current collective bargaining agreement. Slotting means that a rookie's potential contract will largely be determined by their spot, and is based on that
year's overall salary cap. It is in part determined by how many draft picks a team has and where those picks are located. So...
You know, that's kind of interesting that they're going to keep that, because that was a big issue of whether or not they were going to keep that slotting system with the uncapped season, because that would normally get thrown out in an uncapped, no collective bargaining agreement season.
Right.
And that kind of, you know... fiscal responsibility, if you want to call it that, or fiscal limitations on rookie contracts, is something that the owners were very interested in having and expanding.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that they're going to keep that. But, you know, you can't really combat, like, the last year's draft. There was a big problem. Sports fans remember that Michael Crabtree sat out a lot of the start of the season for the 49ers because he didn't get a contract of his liking.
That's right.
Because the Raiders and critic Al Davis...
Mm-hmm.
Decided that they were going to draft Darius Hayward Bay and give him this insane contract.
Right.
And Crabtree's whole argument was, I'm at least better than this guy, I want as much money.
Right.
And the Niners were saying, you know, no, the slotting system, like, you get, you know, money that would go with the slot that you were drafted.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't help that Al Davis is a nutbag.
Right.
And so, you know, it's going to be something interesting, especially to watch these labor negotiations go on between the NFL and the owners. We're going to talk a little bit more about that with the pay and taxes later.
Right. Yeah, we also have the NFL Players Association accused the league Tuesday of not sharing as much supplemental revenue with its low-income teams as it's supposed to. And we talked a little bit about this before, but... I guess this is sort of a developing story. Jeffrey Kessler, the outside counsel for the NFL PA, said the NFLPA is filing this new proceeding because it has discovered that the NFL did not provide its lower revenue clubs with all of the supplemental revenue sharing that was promised in the CBA for the 20 years, or for the years 2006 to 2008. This is a quote from Kessler. He goes on to say, such funds are important to ensure that the lower revenue teams can field competitive teams, offer competitive salaries, and provide their fans with hope for success on the field each NFL season. Special master.
Remember, we had talked about this when the owners had tried to dismantle this program.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
In the uncapped season, saying, you know, they no longer were obligated. Mm-hmm. And one of our favorite Not Another Sports Show titles, Special Master, shot that down and ruled in favor of the Players Association. So, you know, it seems to me this is another allegation that's going to look very badly on the owners, that they were underfunding their own program to help out the small market team.
That's right.
And, you know, when you look at some of these small market teams, they were outright terrible this season.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, it's true. And, you know, I mean, you know, if they want to maintain this, you know, this story that that these teams can sort of feed into the local economy, you know, in the towns that they're located in, certainly underfunding them, you know, is not a good way to do that.
yes, definitely underfunding, you know, the revenue sharing is not the best idea. And
absolutely,
a lot of teams are, you know, because they're actually, the owners are actually having to pay the brunt of building new stadiums and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They're not nearly as profitable.
Right.
And that's one of the big issues going into their labor negotiations, is that because the owners can't get taxpayers to foot the bill anymore right now in the recession,
mm-hmm.
they're demanding that other people do it.
Right.
And if the players aren't going to do it, then they'll shut down the game.
That's right. Yep. Extortion, I think, is one way to put that,
yes.
right?
Yes.
Oh, man.
Extortion. Exactly.
let's see. We also have some more NFL news. Last week, we covered the pay of NFL commissioner and other office brass. And it isn't just with some negativity. Vikings defensive end Ray Edwards had some critical statements about pay of NFL leadership. He said, "I don't see him out there getting hit or nothing like that. The commissioner makes $9 million, so you tell me where the balance is. He doesn't put his life on the line. He pushes a pin. At most..." right, I mean...
Which is the point we were making, but I think it has a little extra oomph when
exactly.
it comes from an actual player.
Quite elegantly put, right? At most, Edwards would make approximately one-third of Goodell's salary. Edwards is also angry that, due to the uncapped season, he will be a restricted free agent, rather, which allows the Minnesota Vikings to make any offer another team makes to him. In a normal cap season, he would be an unrestricted free agent and free to sign with any team. So
yeah, a lot of players are upset with that. There's over 200 players that, on a normal salary cap collective bargaining agreement season,
mm-hmm.
that they would be allowed to be unrestricted free agents after 4 years in the league.
Right, right.
And now with the no salary cap, no collective bargaining agreement in place, it goes up to 6 seasons.
Right.
And so all of these players who thought they were going to get a amazing payday are now no longer guaranteed that amazing payday because of the fact that this bargaining agreement's not letting them.
Right, right.
And it's nice to see some fairly class-conscious players. I mean, you know, the players are the ones out there, you know, getting hurt. The players are the ones out there risking their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was listening to a lot of sports media recently and talking about this, and they were calling this player a fool. And their argument was that these, you know, the players are interchangeable, so they shouldn't make as much money. You know, it takes a special guy to head up these, you know, these kind of proceedings. It takes a special man to do it. And, you know, it takes special behavior. No. No, one suit can replace another suit just as easily.
Pretty much.
Roger Goodell hasn't done anything so amazing that, you know, other suits haven't done in the past.
Right. I mean, when you're talking that kind of pay disparity, right, I mean, making three times as much, you know, as a star player, right?
And not even really a star player. He's kind of, well, you know, he hasn't really been coming into his own yet.
But
he's making, you know, he's making millions of dollars to sit in an office and, make threats against the union if they're not going to build new, if they're not going to pay for new stadiums.
Pretty much, pretty much. So yeah, I mean, I don't know what to make of this. What actually is he doing to justify that money? So yeah, I think Ray Edwards put it really well. You know, that was quite eloquently put.
You know, let the actual workers own the fruits of their labor.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Instead of, you know, an owner, or, you know, he's kind of leadership brass taking it millions comparatively.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What's next?
Let's see. We have other Vikings players dealing with legal issues that may have some interesting ramifications. Kevin and Pat Williams were were suspended for testing positive for banned substances, but they allege the NFL mishandled their tests. A judge says that for Kevin and Pat Williams' case to proceed, they have to prove they are employed by the NFL, while the league maintains that they are solely Viking employees. It's interesting that in this case, the NFL is saying that they are not one entity, right? And yet in American Needle versus the NFL, the NFL is arguing that they are one entity. So it's like whenever, you know, whenever it's advantageous to them,
yeah,
you know, they're right, one, yeah. Sometimes they're not one, the other, another time, you know, whenever they need it to be that way.
it's amazing that, you know, like, in this case, they're going to argue that they're employees of the Vikings and that there's 32 independent franchises, mm-hmm. and they're all totally independent of one another, just under one umbrella of the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you realize the commissioner of the NFL controls the scheduling of the game, the commissioner of the NFL can suspend people unilaterally.
Right, right. Yeah,
without
exactly.
having the team's involvement, that they are players of the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
They might be, you know, but they're subcontracted to whatever team.
Exactly, exactly.
And, you know, and it's advantageous for them to say, you know, they're just strictly Vikings players. There's 32 franchises. And we talked a little bit about American Needle versus the NFL on this broadcast before.
Mm-hmm.
And in that Supreme Court case, what's happening is they're arguing that they're one entity and each individual franchise can't have their own company, like American Needle, produce the swag
right.
for the game.
Right.
And in the Supreme Court right now, the NFL, out of the other side of its mouth, is arguing that they're one corporate entity.
Right.
And therefore, being only one corporate entity, they've got, you know, the ability to do this kind of thing.
Right. I mean, this isn't something unique to the NFL. I mean, this is almost standard operating procedure for big corporations that operate under sort of a franchise system, right? I mean, Coca-Cola does this. You know, they have supposedly independent bottling plants in every country in which Coca-Cola is sold. Yet, they dictate all of the, the parameters of how Coca-Cola is produced in each of those facilities. Their managers are trained by Coca-Cola. Everyone who works there wears Coca-Cola uniforms with the Coca-Cola logo. But if you object to Coca-Cola, the national corporate or the corporation that's headquartered in Atlanta, Georgia, about labor issues, labor violations, environmental issues, and in some of their plants overseas, they'll always come back and say, that's not really us. That's
yeah.
you know that that's the bottling company. That's not our and it's like this whole franchise structure just allows a company to hide like that, right? I mean, and if the NFL is doing exactly the same thing, right?
Oh, yeah. And the thing is with the NFL, like, if they're allowed to become one corporate entity, and the real danger of this Supreme Court case
mm-hmm.
is if they're allowed to become this one corporate entity,
mm-hmm.
in their interests, they can do all sorts of crazy things, like tickets. You thought ticket prices were expensive now and it was difficult to get a family to get to a game.
Mm-hmm.
Watch what happens, because they're one corporate entity, therefore, you know, it's in their corporate interest to make more profits.
That's right.
So, therefore, they're going to increase ticket prices.
Of course.
You know, Drew Brees, the quarterback and the guy who dressed up in the Super Bowl celebration for Fat Tuesday, in the Bacchanalia, he dressed up as Bacchus,
mm-hmm.
Which was quite an amusing picture. You can find it online. It's really kind of funny. Took time out right before the Super Bowl to testify to a grand jury about this and said, you know, this is the exact kind of thing we need to be on the lookout for.
Mm-hmm.
Because when they started this kind of crap, the amount of ticket prices and swag have gone up.
Right, right.
Since this has been introduced. And this is going to be the kind of dangerous thing. In the name of getting their profits, they're going to be more than willing to do this. And it's going to put fans completely out in the dust.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree. It's a mess. anyway.
Boo owners.
Boo owners, that's right. Boo corporate power.
Boo.
Boo.
I was saying boo earns.
No, we're not. Let's see. I have another story that I want this to be sort of a seg into a broader discussion about the Olympics, but I'd also mention a little bit about Coca-Cola and their franchise structure and everything. And so trust me that this is sort of at least tangentially related to sports.
We'll get there.
We'll make it fit. But it's an interesting story, and I think people should be aware of this. So there was a strike by 3,000 workers launched by the Food and Allied Workers Union on December 22nd at the South Africa brewery, that's SAB Miller. They have a soft drink division, ABI. And that strike ended on Tuesday after an agreement was reached between the union and the company on raises. Raises were a big issue for them. ABI is a major bottler and distributor of Coca-Cola products in South Africa, and the union was demanding an end to the use of contractors and what Coke likes to refer to as driver-owner schemes, which convert truck drivers into, you know, supposedly independent owner-operators, and their crews into casual workers deprived of decent working conditions and job security. So the idea was, you know, get as few people as possible being official Coca-Cola employees or official employees of the Coke franchised bottling company, right? So, but these people still wear Coke uniforms. They still wear the Coke logo on their shirts. They're disciplined if they don't wear the Coke logo. You know, it's like basically they work for the company, but through some kind of, you know, legalese shell game, they're able to keep them off the books, so they don't need to pay payroll taxes for them. They don't need to, you know, necessarily go into collective bargaining agreements with them because they're free contractors. They're not, you know, supposedly employees. So this was a big bone of contention with them. It doesn't look like a decent resolution came about on that issue. The details of the contract are a little bit sketchy, but anyway, the union stresses that those schemes were presented as black empowerment, you know, as sort of supporting some kind of idea of entrepreneurship in South Africa, right? But they're just a means of dividing the workforce and creating inferior working conditions in their delivery service. So this strike that recently ended received huge support from workers at all four of the ABI production plants, and it triggered a one-day sympathy strike for the South Africa brewery workers as well. The union accepted the ABI's offer to increase wages 7.8%. Their original demand was an increase of 9.5%. This is a statement from management, right? We are most pleased that we have reached an agreement with FAWU, that's the union, which ends the strike at ABI. This is from John Eustace, the managing director of the soft drinks business. He goes on to say, "We will not now focus on welcoming those employees who went on strike back to work, ensuring that we fully normalize our operations." Among other things, they had agreed to overtime pay for weekends and a 45-hour work week. But, I mean, overall, after these wages are all said and done, you know, the increase to their wages are all said and done, we're still looking at, like, $944 a month for these workers. You know, I mean, it's still not a lot of money. And South Africa is a relatively developed country, you know, with a relatively expensive standard of living. These people are not making a lot of money.
So how does this tie into the Olympics?
So Coca-Cola, as you know, is a big sponsor of the Olympics, right? I mean, they're launching into, like, the, you know, just $100 million at hundreds of millions of dollars in their ad campaigns, right? So there's
because, you know, when I look at those chiseled athletes, I see them drinking nothing but Coke during
That's
their
right.
training regimen.
Exactly.
So it's like back in 08 when Michael Phelps bought the Chinese kids to McDonald's.
Exactly.
Like, oh, my kidding. Michael Phelps probably doesn't even know how to spell McDonald's, let alone, you know, want to order food.
Exactly. I mean, that by itself is hilarious, right? I mean, a product that is so intrinsically unhealthy for you sponsors one of the greatest Olympic, you know, one of the greatest international athletic events in the world.
And that's what Coke's doing.
Yeah, Coke does that, and Coke, you know, not just with the Olympics, but they use the Olympics in a lot of ways to try to promote themselves as a really family friendly, you know, really moral, ethical, good, you know, corporate citizen, global corporate citizen, and they are just not. You know, whenever this company comes down on either side of a moral issue, they almost invariably come down on the wrong side. You know, and I mean, this is one case where they're, you know, they're gouging people's wages, you know, they're forcing them into, you know, inferior working conditions, trying to deny them their rights to collective bargaining. This happens all over the place. They there's been,
well, it's a step up from being killed, like Columbia.
Yeah, that's right. There was an actual Coke employee who was killed inside the plant in Columbia.
By a right-wing paramilitary terrorist group,
right.
The AUC.
That's right, and the person who's in command of that group actually goes out for a beer with the manager of that bottling plant.
Yeah.
Like they're good chumps, right? But the police are unable to find any connection whatsoever between the murder and.
Well, they've also had instances with a lot of the organizing that was going on in Coke bottling plants in Colombia where. The paramilitaries basically were outside the boss's desk one day in his office, and mm-hmm. they called in the individual unionists
mm-hmm.
and told them, you've got three choices. Leave the union, leave the country, or you might die.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that kind of strong-arming, you know, and when it got brought to Coke, it was first, you know, deny, 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 then became, well, you know, they're just a bottler, they're not Coke representatives, they're just
exactly.
just a bottling plant that, you know, and that kind of plausible deniability to, you know, not want to get involved, but it's very clear that if Coke wanted to get involved in this situation, they could have.
Oh, absolutely.
And
I mean,
last night when I was watching, I stayed up late watching curling last night.
Okay.
Oh my god, I love curling. Greatest sport. It is one of the great sports that never gets any kind of airtime.
Let me just clarify. This from a man who thinks that soccer is boring. Okay, I just want to put that out there.
Curling is entertaining. Why? Because there's stuff happening all the time.
Okay.
Points can be scored. There's strategy, you know, and there's action, like boom, 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 boom.
Okay.
And plus, you get to hear people scream, and they get to, like, run with brushes.
Okay, they don't have that in soccer. I'll grant you that. Okay. But anyway, you were making a point. You were watching curling last night.
They had these commercials
mm-hmm.
Talking about, you know, like, these athletes winning gold or, you know, these athletes, you know, that have done amazing things, you know, mm-hmm. and talking about, you know, family moments being brought to you by Coke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's unfortunate that some of these Colombian unions no longer get to have family moments because Coke didn't do anything when they were shooting their families.
That's right. And that's not just an isolated incident. I mean, we have this example from South Africa. We have you know, the Coke...
The poisoning of the water in India.
That's right. And, you know, the depleting of wells for drinking water and agricultural, you know, irrigation in India. I mean, there's villages that are that have just completely dried up, literally, because a Coke plant came in. You know, and they were hoping for, you know, some decent high-paying jobs. They didn't even get that, as it turns out. You know, it's... No, I mean, they just spread misery everywhere they go. So don't...
Unless for us, at least Coke didn't heavily advertise too much on the Super Bowl.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
That was kind of nice.
That's true. Yeah, there was a lot of beer commercials and chip commercials. I didn't see a lot of Coke.
Those advocacy ads. I learned that if there's a, you know, like, 5-year-old black child with a bowl of Doritos, I do not need to touch those Doritos, nor do I need to touch his mother. It was an advocacy ad.
It was a funny commercial. It was a cute commercial, right? I mean, it was on par with the Samurai Doritos guy.
Yes.
Anyway, yeah. But
so,
anyway,
you know, we talked a bit about the Olympics last week. Yet there's more and more information coming out about this that we haven't gotten to yet.
Absolutely. No, it's. I mean, I think we should just do the rest of the show on the Olympics. I mean, we should have a little bit of room for the better known owner, but.
We got to talk Tiger. I mean,
oh,
you know,
yeah, that's right.
I mean, yes, we have about, you know, half the American public that would rather gargle with urine than hear more about Tiger Woods. And the other half that, you know, we just, like, demand that you make something up just to get them more information. And so we, you know, with his you know, most recent mea culpa, it's so prevalent everywhere. I think it would be incumbent on us, you know, we've avoided it as long as we can, you know, talking about, you know, this man deserves his privacy, but now since he's come out in public and he's made a statement, I think it's fair game for us to publicly address it and deal with that topic later on in the broadcast.
Let me just say, this is becoming a really ubiquitous sort of a public act, right? I mean, this speech asking for the public forgiveness for sexual indiscretion, right? I mean, we see it. It's generally from politicians, right? But it's just a weird phenomenon, right? I mean, for one thing, why is he apologizing to us? You know, I mean.
Yeah, well, we can get into that. Let's finish our headline.
Yeah,
you know, we got the Green Olympics, so green that the ice resurfacer broke, and so they brought in the traditional propane powered Zamboni.
That's right.
To do the work.
Now, yeah, the original ones that they had intended to use were electric powered, and apparently just didn't quite have the power to get the job done.
So, you know, there's all this talk of the Green Olympics and everything being so green and all that kind of necessary.
Well, yeah.
And
I think they weren't planning on like a, you know, like 20 or 30 helicopter airlifts for, to bring in snow, either. There's going to be a bit of carbon offset they're going to require for that, too.
Yeah, you know, you have, you know, helicopters coming in 20, 30 times a day to drop off snow. it's just one thing after another. I mean, you know, if you want to hear more in-depth stuff about the Olympics, you can listen to last week's broadcast. We talked a lot about the Olympic resistance right off the bat at the start.
Mm-hmm.
But there's more and more stuff like this that keep coming up. I mean, one of the things after we got home from our broadcast, one of the first news stories we're going to talk about in a minute, was the violence that took place at the Olympics, mm-hmm. from the protesters. You know, just like, and it reminded me exactly of 1999 in Seattle, which being part of the indie media, being part of the IMC, you know, we had a park, you know, being formed as a result of the battle in Seattle. And they used, you know, the violence of these two black bloc anarchists to try to discredit the whole anti-globalization movement.
Right, right.
It's in the same way that, you know, for those of you not familiar, there was the Vancouver anti-Olympics heart attack to clog the arteries of capitalism that was called to block off the streets in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of activists had thrown rocks through windows and splashed paint in only in select stores. And the mainstream media tried playing this off as, you know, the anarchists are back at it again, and, you know, and discredited, you know, a lot of the anti-Olympic movement. Even the Olympic Resistance Network started, you know, backing away from these kind of tactics.
Right.
And, you know, and while you may, you know, we can debate the efficacy of, you know, smashing a window as a political statement, but, you know, there's some background that went missing in the way the mainstream media covered this, right, Damien?
That's right.
So if you want to elaborate on that for us.
Let me see, where did we have that info?
We're waiting for Damien to find the information.
I may not have it here, actually.
It's the whole story about the one, yeah, we're going to go with the difficulty because I don't have my computer in front of me because I'm at mile marker 106 coming back at 72 East. If anybody's listening right now, obviously I am not home. Please do not rob me.
So,
thanks.
Yeah, so we have some info about, you know, I guess the social situation, the social impact of having the Olympic Games here. We have, you know, just blocks away from the city's, you know, waterfront. You know, and the nice, you know, panoramic views that you'll see on NBC, you know, of the Winter Olympics. There's a small storefront where addicts come with their illegal drugs. They register their names and substances of choice, heroin, speed, morphine, and other injectables to use it all they want. There are no catches. except that addicts are required to inject themselves under the supervision of nurses who provide clean needles, alcohol swabs, and a protected place to steady themselves before they plunge back back to the streets. It is the only facility of its kind in North America, and it's won support of local political leaders and even the tacit approval of the Vancouver police. The organizers of the Harm Reduction Facility are using the Olympics to publicize this non-police, non-militarized option to the drug war. Sort of interesting, yeah. Right? I mean, this is something that's, almost seems deliberately, one of those things that's just swept under the rug, in this really well-scripted, Olympics coverage that you'll see from NBC. It's always going to be this picturesque image of Vancouver, right?
And not blocks away at the lower downtown east side of Vancouver.
That's right, yeah. You'll never see that.
Pretty much like a third world country, almost.
Exactly. Well, I mean, that's been the way it was for just about every single Olympics, right? I mean, Beijing has its slums. You never saw that.
And like we talked about last week, the posh thing was to poop all over the, the Beijing games for, the suppressions of civil liberties, slums, being, more and more people being made homeless, class inequality. Mm-hmm. It's not just a Beijing thing. It's a Olympics institutional thing.
Right.
And no town should have to go through this and have a $6 billion bill at the end of it to host a sporting event.
Mm-hmm.
There are ways to host sporting events that don't harbor, and don't foster and foment such deep inequality.
That's right.
And, the surprising thing is, I was talking to one of our other fellow Wobblies, and, he was interested in, I bet you don't see these kind of radical things before, but he sent me some different articles.
Uh-huh.
And so I sent him this one, and surprisingly, this story about the harm reduction clinic was actually covered in USA Today Sports.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, USA Today, the newspaper that goes out to the very, vast majority of the public. Covered.
No, that was... That's more the exception than the rule as far as, coverage of these sort of fringe social issues that surround the Olympics.
Yeah, and as we were talking about with the anarchists and that kind of, destruction of property, I think it's actually the next story where they talk about the heart of the people protest. While we were on the air last week, there was the heart attack being set up by anti-Olympics activists in Vancouver that were using a variety of protest methods. Even though the city of Vancouver has said that it's illegal to have an amplified voice module like a bullhorn near an Olympic facility.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had a whole host of, talking about the street violence that had taken place, and one of those companies has had a very storied history when it comes to dealing with the Indigenous peoples of Canada. Did you find that one yet, Damien?
I think it's the very next one. I wonder if I just don't even have... Let's see. There's this whole... the Christian Science Monitor was talking about how...
Yeah, that's
right, the one. Right. That the Olympics have a history of leaving host cities in debt and of relocating the poor and homeless away from, sort of sanitized corridors of host cities. And while we were on the air Saturday, a number of protesters were out for this, what Neil was talking about, the Olympic heart attack, right? They occupied and blocked streets. They broke windows at places like the Hudson Bay Company, also known as HBC. HBC has a long history of economic imperialism and trade relationships with natives in Canada from the 17th century. From a history of Indigenous resistance in Canada, under a royal charter, the HBC was responsible for trade regulations, settlement, and government governance. The company had the military backing of the Royal Navy gunboats, while also maintaining its own security forces. The wealthy businessmen of the HBC quickly established private enterprises such as mines, sawmills, and canneries, and sold land to settlers to pay for the construction of roads, ports, and other infrastructure. As animal populations declined, many Sequipemic became dependent on the fur trade for survival. Periods of starvation hit the Sequipemic from 1822, 1827, and throughout the 1840s and 1850s, and many of their children died in a 1927 whooping cough outbreak. Throughout this phase of colonization, the HBC sent annual gifts of tobacco to the chiefs to dissuade them from waging war on the company. And these chiefs often became businessmen themselves. At least two of these chiefs saw the damage of the fur trade that was being done and urged a boycott. And many of their warriors took a direct approach, regularly attacking fur traders' property and robbing Hudson Bay employees. In 1826, Fort Kamloops was burned to the ground by indigenous insurgents. It was rebuilt by, with a fence by the Hudson's Bay Company in 1843, only to come under renewed attack. HBC was also involved in burning native villages, promoting smallpox outbreaks to further consolidate their power. And, you know, this is why this company was targeted. It wasn't just a, you know, a random thing. This ties into, you know, the whole native soil issue behind deploying the Winter Olympics in Vancouver.
Yes, and you know, and you know, the mainstream media wants to play this off as, you know, another set of anarchists, you know, just messing stuff up for the sake of messing stuff up.
Right.
And it's not. I mean, you know, this had a very direct political statement from this long history of economic and social imperialism over indigenous natives.
Mm-hmm.
And this company has, you know, profited off of corpses of these natives.
Exactly. Quite literally,
and
in fact, yeah.
Now, you know, a little bit of comeuppance. Some of that profit now has to go back into fixing their storefront.
Yeah, that's right. But, I mean, this is, I mean, to say this is just sort of a one-off thing.
Smash your window to make your political point. But, I mean, we really have to disabuse ourselves of that notion that, you know, there is nothing behind it besides, you know, the Joker-like anarchists who just want to see the world burn.
Right.
No.
Right.
It was a political statement. You can agree or disagree with, you know, the method they used, but it was, at heart, a political statement.
Right.
And that was something that was sorely lacking in all the coverage I was watching. Just used to vastly discredit.
Well, I mean, it just completely denies the historical context of it, right? It's not a one-off thing. This is one event in a long, ongoing struggle between between Hudson Bay Company and the Native people in Canada, right?
Right.
You know, this think of it as just one more violent event, granted, but in defense of, you know, related to these issues of social justice. There you have it, right?
What's our next story?
Last week we covered a story about the Football Association athletes not wanting to participate in the anti-homophobia ads. Remember that?
It's soccer, not football. Football is a bunch of grown men running into each other at full strength wearing pads.
Okay.
Soccer is where they run around and kick a ball.
I mean, okay, when we refer to the Football Association, we're referring to the sport of football as it is known in every other country in the world.
Football Norte Americano. It's, you know, this is soccer, okay?
Yeah. But anyway, in a somewhat related issue to that, the lacrosse captain, Andrew McIntosh, at Oneonta State University in New York, was subject to an interesting story that was posted on OutSports. He was on the point of being suicidal, and he was speaking with other gay athletes about the issue and eventually came out to his coach. And his coach was exceptionally supportive. He even said that if half the team didn't want to play on the team because of McIntosh's sexual orientation, the coach would ask those team members to quit. So there's a lot of support out there for inclusiveness in athletics, and I think people should just come forward.
A lot of different locker rooms, like, they've asked coaches, like when Isaiah Thomas used to coach and be part of the Knicks, you know, they asked him, and he said, you know, I don't think it would be any problem in my locker room, and anybody who had a problem with it, we'd, we'd deal with it with them, rather than, you know,
right,
having the person hide their sexual orientation.
Exactly.
And, you know, this is the kind of thing, you know, it's, you know, more about liberation. If you want to look at, you know, society, you look at it through sports, mm-hmm. and, you know, this is one of the, you know, increasing things about, you know, LGBT. You know, when the National Equality March took place, you had two different players, Ravens linebacker Brendan Iovadejo, came out in support of gay marriage, and making the very clear analogy to the Jim Crow marriage laws in the South that stop anti-miscegenation laws. And then Scott Fujita, the linebacker of the Super Bowl New Orleans Saints, who that? Sorry, just force of habit. Came out and supported the National Equality March and became quite outspoken about it and said that most locker rooms would be open to gay athletes. Even though there is that kind of, you know, stigma, thanks to, you know, Roosevelt and the whole masculine Christianity idea, that, you know, athletes need to be manly men and, you know, they're sissies if they're not manly and all that kind of stuff, which is completely ridiculous.
Well, I mean, it was almost like he was overcompensating, right? I mean, he was a sickly child, you know, growing up, and, you know, it's like he wanted to really sculpt his image as the opposite of that, I guess, when he tried to take on political career.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's something that, you know, it's a lot of damage that was done that needs to be undone, I guess, you know, the...
It's a good start, and if you're interested in LGBTQ rights as it relates to sports... Outsports is a fantastic resource for those kind of stories. They're really good about covering those kind of issues.
Sure.
And has it relate to sports.
Sure. Let's see. We also have a story about football coach salaries. While colleges have seen cuts to programs and increases in tuition, Nebraska has followed Texas' suit and given a raise to their men's football coach. It added another year to the contract of head coach Bo Pelini and raised his base pay to $2.1 million. The deal is designed to keep Pelini at the Huskers' helm through February 28, 2015. It provides a retention bonus as well, $500,000 if he's still head coach on January 31st of 2015. The other coaches and specialists on the team are also making six-figure salaries. So, you know, some of these universities are finding money.
Yeah, they're finding money for certain things, you know, and, you know, meanwhile there's, like, talk of furloughs and all this other stuff. And,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, I love the, you know, the, well, we won't take a pay raise, like, you know, they're going to ask, I'm like, well, we won't take a pay raise. Yeah, but you're still making a lot. Okay?
Exactly.
You know, a 0% raise on a lot still leaves you with a lot.
Exactly. Or, you know, I mean, or like as a publicity stunt, maybe even taking a cut, right? I mean, you're already making six figures, you know, that kind of
stuff. I think the final story we've got is NBA Commissioner Stern.
Yeah, David Stern.
Projecting that the NBA is going to lose $400 million this season. And that was the reason behind the first negotiation contract proposal that was described as a photocopy of Stern's middle finger.
That's right.
And he said, you know, he's like, we're willing to listen to a union proposal as long as they accept the kind of economic calamity that we're in.
Right.
And I can, like, you know, the NBA is having a big problem. While all the other major sports in this country, even soccer, are expanding, the NBA is contracting. Fewer fans are going to games. And, you know, they're having a difficult time advertising and getting that out to the public.
Right.
Two and four people are, you know, spending a lot of money on basketball. And, you know, like, it's gotten to the point where they're having, like, paper the arenas to get people into the games. And, you know, tarping off seats and stuff like that. And there's just certain cities that have been given franchises in the name of expansion that can't handle a successful franchise.
Right.
And, you know, and that's going to become this dangerous precedent. And then you also have, you know, these owners that give out max contracts to terrible, terrible people that don't deserve max contracts, and then want to go back and, like, renegotiate after the fact. You know, it's like, you know, it's like, we can take the whole Gilbert Arenas thing. Okay, yeah, Gilbert Arenas hurt his knee. We won't even go into the gun stuff, but let's say he hurt his knee. He wasn't the same as before. And you want to, you know, try to renegotiate the contract. Well, then you shouldn't have given him a $180 million deal in the first place.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's these kind of realities that we're dealing with And so it's going to be really kind of interesting to watch where the NBA labor negotiations go to as well, seeing how they're just starting the first opening salvos of proposal exchanges.
Right, right. Yeah, and it really was not off to a good start.
And speaking of things not off to a good start...
Oh, do we have to talk... Is this a lead-up to Tiger?
Tiger Woods!
Oh, okay.
Okay, now, Damien, I can see where you're coming from. You're that half the population that, you know...
Would just is tired rather, of it, yeah. You know,
yeah, that are so tired of it that, you know... you'd rather poop razor blades than deal with it again.
I would consider it. Anyway, let's hear your take on it, Neil. You're itching for this. I just feel it, right?
we have this, you know, the general public consensus about Tiger Woods. You have half the population that's like, damn it, doesn't want to talk about it from day one.
Yeah.
You know, my whole thing has been, and that's why we haven't covered it so much in this show, Amy and I agreed, you know, this is a private issue for Helene and the kids and his family, his mom and dad, you know, and everybody and his family and friends to deal with.
Yep, absolutely.
And it's not a, you know, thing like, you know, watching him, you know, making sure he's going in or coming out of a Mississippi sex rehab clinic. I really didn't care. You know, like, if he's going in rehab, good for him. That's his own personal decision.
Mm-hmm.
But yesterday, he did come out. He made a 13.5-minute speech owning up to, you know, affairs and taking the blame for those affairs. And my take on it was, you know, I can see why he did it, but it's not going to leave him in a good place. The half the population that, you know, would rather strap themselves and, you know, douse themselves in lighter fluid and pull a Buddhist monk in 1968 rather than hear about Mutt games anymore. Versus, you know, they don't want to, you know, listen to 13.5 more minutes of him prattling on, which is going to lead to more media coverage.
Exactly, right? I mean...
And the other half of the population is going to want more. It reminds me of that, you know, and that part of, like, the voyeuristic part of this public reminds me of that old joke about the sexual assault where this woman's describing it in the courtroom, and then she's like, and I blacked out, and I can't remember. And the judge just says, well, make something up!
My God. That's terrible.
And, you know, people want to just keep getting detail after sorted detail after sorted detail. And, you know, if I was in the position of being Tiger or one of Tiger's handlers, I think this is the exact way I would have handled the thing. Hello and welcome. I'm publicly apologizing to my wife, my friends, my family, and my children, because what I had done publicly embarrassed them, and for that I owe them a public apology.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of you, it's none of your damn business. Thank
yes.
you and good day.
Exactly, right? I mean, the only way I can see this as being in any way justified is if maybe his counselor or something said that this was some kind of cathartic thing for him to do, right? I mean, otherwise the timing of it just seems bizarre. I mean, he's still in rehab or therapy or whatever you want to call it. He's still, you know, trying to resolve things with his wife and his family, right? Why bring it up now? I mean, people are starting to quiet down about Tiger. I mean, and this just throws gas on you know, the coals of this controversy, right? I mean, just let it simmer down. Finish your therapy or rehab, whatever. Finish, you know, resolving things with your family, and then make your comeback, you know, and then say, you know, we've worked things out. I'm really sorry for all the shame and humiliation I brought to my family, blah, blah, blah. I went through therapy. It went well, blah, blah, blah. I'm ready to start playing golf and making some money to support my family, blah, 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 you know. And then you have then there seems to be some sort of justification for this. But otherwise, it was just, you know, what, why? You know, you haven't resolved anything yet. You're just inflaming this whole thing over again, right?
Well, I think that, you know, it was good of him to come out and make a public statement.
Maybe.
And, you know, the way he did it, you know, it was, you know, it's not going to be enough red meat for the people that want to hear it, and it's going to be annoying to the people that don't.
Yeah.
You know, and there was a great flow chart a friend of mine at this convention I was at today showed me, of Tiger Woods, and said, do you deserve an apology from Tiger Woods? And it's like, question number one, were you married to Tiger Woods? If you said no, there was a line that said, Tiger Woods doesn't owe you a damn thing.
Nice.
And then it said, were you married to Tiger Woods? Yes. And it's like, okay, maybe you deserve an apology. And then there's like another line coming out of the no box. It's like, did you know Tiger Woods? Did you have an affair with Tiger Woods? No. Did you know he was married? No. Well, maybe you deserve an apology. Yes, Tiger Woods doesn't owe you a damn thing.
Nice.
And, you know, like, it's going to inflame the issue, but it wasn't going away in the first place. You know, you still had people, you know, writing the "What were you thinking?" columns, and even before he said word one, people were all there. You know, the sports columnists were already condemning him. Like, he's not letting anybody ask any questions. Well, what questions were you going to ask?
I mean, he doesn't owe them anything, right? I mean, this whole thing has been.
You read the sports columns. It's like, well, the questions we're going to ask, like, what were you thinking? Yeah, well, what were you thinking when you write stupid columns? What that, you know?
Yeah.
What are you thinking when you're doing some of this stuff, you know?
Yeah, and you call that journalism? Right, yeah, it's, yeah.
And it goes back to, you know, this thing even further, which back we had D.K. Wilson on the show from Sports in My Mind, this fascination with black athlete sexuality.
Yep.
I mean, you know, we saw it when the Creedy Sizemore dude picks. Mm-hmm. Came out that he had sent to his girlfriend, somehow got leaked to the media.
Right,
and
right.
And got put up. Greg Oden's naked pictures. You know, all these kind of things. It's like, there seems to be this innate fascination with black athlete penis. And I don't get it. And, you know, and this sordid kind of wanting to deal with it. And, you know, Woods has become a victim of that. And,
yeah.
There's going to be people that are going to keep demanding the pound of flesh from him. And in all honesty, he shouldn't give it to him. Just, you know, it looks like he's taking the rehab seriously because he didn't give, you know, oh, I'm coming back, you know, at
right.
such and such time. He, you know, whenever I get, you know, whenever I come back, I come back.
Right. I mean.
And it's time for the media to leave him the hell alone. Leave Tiger alone!
I have to say, I mean, he did, I listened to some excerpts of it. He did sound contrite, right? I mean, he did sound sincere, and maybe, you know, his wife might be feeling a little bit better about this, but, you know, it's, at this point, it really is just an issue between him and his family, and,
right.
Yeah, I mean,
he doesn't know anybody any other details, which is why I applaud him for not taking questions.
Yeah.
I mean, if there were going to be questions you wanted to ask him, like, okay, how about your affiliations with Nike, which have huge human rights abuses? What about your affiliations with, you know, the Dubai Golf Course, Dubai being the child sex capital
uh-huh.
of the world?
Yep, uh-huh.
You know, and those kind of questions. I can see those kind of questions being asked of him.
That's right, yeah.
But nothing, I really don't care who he slept with and where, because it's not, you know, I wasn't married to him.
Exactly.
And, you know, we also had one other quick issue we wanted to bring up.
The Georgian Luger.
The Georgian Luger, or as Amy Goodman called him, the Luge player, Rich Nagel.
Nice. Yeah. He was on the Luge team, right?
Really unfortunate event. I'm sure most of you have heard about Georgian Luge athlete who had died after he crashed at the track and hit headfirst into a pole.
Yeah.
Very quickly, the Olympics, you know, went into an investigation and said that he was at fault for not correctly compensating on the track.
Well,
and this is a track that has had a storied history of this is getting pushed too far, we're going too fast, and, you know, and being very, very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people had questioned about it.
Well, even back in 2006, right?
Including this guy in... the day before he went through that practice run, he told his father, this is really dangerous, mm-hmm. I fear for my life on these last two curves that are back-to-back mm-hmm. going so fast. And he's like, but I'm here to win, and I'm here to win or die.
That's right.
And, well, we all know the tragic result.
That's right.
And we even had bobsledders announced this morning. Two Swiss bobsled teams have quit.
That's right. They also had accidents on the track, right? Yeah.
Yeah. They had crashed. They had some crashes, and they quit.
Yeah. I mean, I have a... Go ahead.
And the IOC saying, you know, the track wasn't to blame. Yet they put pads on, they changed the wall on the track, and then they changed the starting position for everybody. But the track wasn't to blame.
Uh-huh. Yeah, then why do that, right?
You know, these are human beings. They're not crash test dummies to throw them down, you know, a thing of ice, you know, holding on to a piece of plastic in sharp metal at 9,500 miles an hour.
Well, you know, I mean, this has been the thing, right? I mean, every Olympics, they want a new record. More than one, right? I mean, they're only happy if they push the envelope a little further each time. And I'm not saying, but it's, you know, it's very likely that was also, you know, some of the thinking that went behind this decision. This track is really pushing the edge. I mean, we have a quote from the 2006 U.S. Silver medalist, Shauna Robach, who said, "I think they went a little overboard on this track. I wish everybody knew what we saw at the bottom. Your brain almost can't catch up with what your hands need to do." This is her words. She goes on to say, "I think at some point it's going to exceed that, and that's when problems will happen." So, I mean, and this is a U.S. silver medalist. I mean, she's performed well in the luge event, and she knows what she's talking about.
Oh, that's bobsled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, this is seriously pushing the limit. Who's to say what's behind it? But it just seems to be this drive for, you know, ever more sensationalist events in the Olympics, just to drive ratings, maybe. Who knows? But it just seems like they always want, you know, more records.
Hey, they got my ratings. I got to watch Denmark Canada in curling last night, and it went to extra frames,
uh-huh.
And then I found out something this morning. The European Curling Federation, it appears, to raise money for charity,
uh-huh.
had the women's curling teams do a semi-nude calendar shoot.
No.
Yes. Including some of the very attractive ladies from the Denmark team. Involved in it. I saw that on Deadspin this morning.
Oh, my.
And, it was an interesting match to watch, and it was just an interesting sport to watch. And, Damien, if you take a moment and find the radio edit version, the clean version of 100 Little Curses online, I'll entertain the people while you find that for a moment.
Sure.
We'll get ready to go into our Better Known Owner segment. Better known owner this week is actually not going to be an owner. He's going to be a special commissioner from Major League Baseball that we're going to talk about. And no, fans, it's not Bud Selig. That one will come later, but he'll definitely be in there.
Okay.
So, you know, we've had a... You found it?
Yeah, I did. But keep going if you want.
We just had this kind of issue about sports politics. You know, from all these major stories we talked about today to, you know, Tiger Woods and, you know, this incessant, you know, fascination with black athletes and black athletes' sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really kind of unbecoming and really kind of frightening that people want to pay that much attention to what's going on, you know, between a black athlete's legs. And it's kind of frightening to me.
No, it is.
And we're going to tie this into a history of black athletes in just a minute. If you want to hit that song for about a minute.
Sure. Let me... I hope this works. Well, Sue Sneed. Hit that off. There we go. All right. Back in a moment, folks.
Down your grandma was there. public Madonna. May this make you vomit on your Dolce & Gabbana. May your wife's worry face show a horrific expression. May you realize she's not worried, that's just Botox injections. May all the commotion call the crash, shit, leer. Let your beard shop diamonds from the beard. May your Ferrari break down. May your chauffeur get high. Smash up your stretch road from Rodeo Drive. Off the breaking back to others where you got all your bucks. Till we make the revolution, I just hope your life sucks. All my people in the place, put your fist in the air. All my down, get up out of your chairs. All my real down, but we got love for you here. Except for that, right there. Get up.
And welcome back to Not Another Sports Show, your progressive look at the world of sports. Our better-known owner segment this week is technically not an owner, but he was enough of a menace on the institution of sports that I had to include him. And that is Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis. Judge Landis, for those of you that are labor activists, it's tied this to labor issues. Damien, do you know what famous people are? Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis oversaw the trial, though?
Oh, let's see. He deported Big Bill Haywood, one of the big union organizers with the IWW. He also deported Emma Goldman.
That's the famous anarchist Emma Goldman.
That's right, and many other labor unionists. He's notorious in labor circles. That's right.
Yes, he is very notorious in labor circles. He was also the judge that presided over the Jack Johnson case.
Yep.
Jack Johnson was an African-American boxer who was convicted of the quote-unquote crime of driving with a white woman across state lines for immoral purposes. The white woman was his wife. If you want more information on that, you can look up a past issue of The Public Eye where I wrote a column called Unforgiven of Blackness, The Legacy of Jack Johnson. He was also involved in really cementing the color line in baseball from 1920 until his death in 1944. And he had very clearly been against racial integration in baseball and was very supportive of segregationist tactics. And when Bill Veeck, who later buys the Chicago White Sox, Veeck was originally in the markets by the Philadelphia Phillies. And Landis single-handedly stopped Veeck from buying the Phillies when he found out one thing. Veeck was going to stack the team with Negro League Doll Stars and integrate the team fully. And Landis stopped him. And it wasn't until a year after Landis died that baseball finally had desegregated with the 1945 signing of a minor league contract by Branch Rickey of Jack Robinson. And, you know, Kennesaw Mountain Landis always told a nasty place for me because he banished the White Sox in the 1919 Black Sox scandal, which these eight players had gambled on the outcome to throw the World Series, mainly due to the minor league status of Charles Kaminsky, who we've also covered in a previous show on Better Known Owner.
That's right.
And so you have these, you know, this huge issue of setting up, you know, this whole racial segregation for decades in baseball. And it was this man single-handedly doing it. And in the aftermath, the new commissioner, Happy Chandler, and, you know, that only comes, like, second to, like, special master, like, you know, being called Happy.
That's right.
It's, like, it's a close second. And when he came in, he publicly disparaged Landis, you know, after Landis had died, about his promotion of segregation in Major League Baseball. And I don't have the exact quote in front of me, Damien, if you wanted to read that for us.
Let me see if I can find it here. Yeah, for 24 years, Judge Landis wouldn't let a black man play. I had his record, and I read them. And for 24 years, Landis consistently blocked any attempts to put blacks and whites together on a big league field. That's Happy Chandler, his successor.
Yes. And, you know, and I think that's a perfect place to end, because black, white, Latin players are all going to be coming together because pitchers and catchers reported this week. So we're looking forward to a brand new baseball season. So next few weeks, we'll catch you back here Saturday at 2 o'clock till 3 o'clock on
RFU 104.5 LPFM. You've listened to another episode of Not Another Sports Show, your progressive look at the world of sports.
Thank you all for tuning in.
Thank you. Bye now.
Bye-bye.